She is recovering her senses!" exclaimed the young man. "Oh, my God, I thank thee!"
"Madam," said Athos, "in the name of heaven, to whom does this empty glass belong?"
"To me, sir,"
replied the young woman in a failing voice. "But who poured out the wine which it contained?"
"She did."
"But who is she?"
"Ah, I remember now,"
said Madame Bonancieux.
"Lady de Winter."
The four friends uttered one unanimous cry, but the voice of Athos overpowered all the others. At the same moment Madame Bonancieux became livid. A deadly spasm assailed her, and she fell panting into the arms of Porthos and Aramis. D'Artagnan grasped the hands of Athos in indescribable anguish.
"Ah!"
said he.
"What do you believe?"
His voice was choked by sobs. "I believe the worst," replied Athos, biting his lips until they bled.
"D'Artagnan!"
exclaimed Madame Bonancieux.
"Where are you? Don't leave me. You see that I'm about to die."
D'Artagnan let go the hands of Athos, which he had pressed convulsively, and ran to her. Her countenance, before so beautiful, was entirely distorted. Her glassy eyes no longer saw. A convulsive shuddering agitated her whole frame, and icy drops were streaming from her brow.
This is the end of disc number 19. Please insert disc number 20. This is disc number 20.
D'Artagnan let go the hands of Athos, which he had pressed convulsively, and ran to her. Her countenance, before so beautiful, was entirely distorted. Her glassy eyes no longer saw. A convulsive shuddering agitated her whole frame, and icy drops were streaming from her brow.
"In the name of heaven, run, Aramis, Porthos, and obtain some assistance!"
"All is useless," said Athos. "All is useless. To the poison which she pours, there is no antidote."
"Yes, yes, help, help,"
murmured Madame Bonancieux. Then, collecting all her strength, she took the hand of the young man between her two hands, looked at him for an instant as though her whole soul were in that last look, and, with a sobbing cry, she pressed her lips upon his.
"Constance! Constance!"
exclaimed D'Artagnan. One sigh came from her lips, breathing over those of D'Artagnan, and that sigh was the passage of her loving soul to eternity. D'Artagnan held only a lifeless body in his arms. He uttered a cry and fell beside his mistress as pale and motionless as herself. Porthos wept. Aramis raised his hand to heaven. Athos crossed himself. At that moment a man appeared at the door, almost as pale as those who were in the chamber. He looked around him and saw Madame Bonancieux dead, and D'Artagnan unconscious. He entered just at the moment of that stupor which succeeds great catastrophes. "I was not mistaken," said he. "That is Monsieur D'Artagnan, and you are his three friends, Monsieur Athos, Porthos, and Aramis." They, whose names had been pronounced, looked at the stranger with astonishment, and all thought that they recognized him. "Gentlemen," said the newcomer, "you, like myself, are seeking a woman, who," added he with a terrible smile, "must have been present here, for I see a dead body." The three friends remained speechless, but the voice, as well as the countenance, recalled to their memory someone they had previously seen, although they could not recollect under what circumstances. "Gentlemen," continued the stranger, "since you will not recognize a man whose life you have probably twice saved, I must needs give my name. I am Lord de Winter, the brother-in-law of that woman." The three friends uttered an exclamation of surprise. Athos arose and offered him his hand. "Welcome, my lord," said he. "You are one of us." "I left Portsmouth 5 hours after her," said Lord de Winter. "Reached Boulogne 3 hours after her. I only missed her by 20 minutes at Saint-Omer. But at Saint-Lillier I lost all trace of her. I wandered about at chance, inquiring of everybody, when I saw you pass at a gallop. I recognized Monsieur D'Artagnan and called out to you, but you did not answer me. I attempted to keep up with you, but my horse was too tired to go at the same pace as yours did. And yet, in spite of all your haste, it seems that you also have arrived too late. The proof is before you, said Athos, pointing to Madame Bonancieux, who was lying dead, and to D'Artagnan, whom Porthos and Aramis were endeavoring to restore to consciousness. Are they both dead? Demanded Lord de Winter coldly. No, happily, replied Athos. Monsieur D'Artagnan has only fainted. Ah, so much the better, said Lord de Winter. In fact, at that moment D'Artagnan opened his eyes. He tore himself from the arms of Porthos and Aramis, and threw himself like a madman on the body of his mistress. Athos arose, walked toward his friend with a slow and solemn step, embraced him tenderly, and then, whilst D'Artagnan broke out into sobs, said to him, in his noble and persuasive tones, My friend, be a man. Women weep for the dead. Men avenge them. Oh, yes, yes, cried D'Artagnan. If it be to avenge her, I am ready to follow you. Athos took advantage of this momentary strength, which the hope of vengeance had given to his unfortunate friend, to make a sign to Porthos and Aramis to fetch the abbess. The two friends met her in the corridor, already much confounded and disturbed by so many events. She called some of the sisters, who, contrary to their conventual habits, found themselves in the presence of five men. "Madam," said Athos, putting his arm under that of D'Artagnan, "we leave to your pious care the body of this unfortunate woman. She was an angel upon earth before she became a saint in heaven. Treat her as if she had been one of your sisters. We will return some day to pray for her soul." D'Artagnan hid his face against Athos's breast and sobbed violently. "Weep," said Athos, "weep, heart full of love and youth and life. Alas, would that I could weep as you do." And he led his friend away, affectionately as a father, consolingly as a priest, and firmly as a man who had himself suffered much. All five, followed by their servants leading their horses, then went towards the town of Béthune, where the suburbs were within sight, and they stopped at the first hotel they found. "But," asked D'Artagnan, "are we not going to follow that woman?" "By and by," said Athos, "but I have some preparations to make." "She will escape," said the young man. "She will escape, Athos, and it will be your fault." "I will answer for her," said Athos. D'Artagnan had such perfect confidence in his friend's promise that he bowed his head and entered the hotel without making the least reply. Porthos and Aramis looked at each other, at a loss to understand the meaning of Athos. Lord de Winter thought that he sought only to soothe the grief of D'Artagnan. "Now, gentlemen," said Athos, when he had ascertained that there were five unoccupied chambers in the hotel, "let each of us retire to his room. D'Artagnan ought to be alone to weep, and you to sleep. I take charge of everything. Make yourselves perfectly easy." "It appears to me, however," said Lord de Winter, "that if any measures are to be taken against the Countess, the concern is mine, seeing that she is my sister-in-law." "And," said Athos, "she is my wife." D'Artagnan started, for he was satisfied that Athos was sure of his revenge to reveal such a secret. Porthos and Aramis looked at one another in consternation, and Lord de Winter thought that Athos had gone mad. "Retire, then," said Athos, "and leave me to act. You see that, in my capacity of husband, this affair belongs to me. Only, D'Artagnan, if you have not lost it, give me that paper which fell from the man's hat, and on which the name of a village is written." "Ah," cried D'Artagnan, "I understand. That name is written by her hand." "You see," said Athos, "that there is still a God in heaven." 64. The Man in the Red Cloak. The despair of Athos had given place to a concentrated grief, which made the brilliant qualities of the man even more lucid. Entirely engrossed by one thought, that of the promise he had made, and of the responsibility he had undertaken, he was the last to retire into his chamber, where he requested the landlord to bring him a map of the province. And then he bent himself over it, examined the lines traced on it, and, ascertaining that four different roads led from Béthune to Armentières, he ordered the valets to be called. Planchet, Grimaud, Mousqueton, and Bazin entered, and received the clear, precise, and serious directions of Athos. At break of day the next morning, they were to set off and proceed to Armentières, each by a different road. Planchet, the most intelligent of the four, was to follow that which had been taken by the carriage at which the three friends had fired, and which was attended, as may be remembered, by the lackey of Count Rochefort. Athos entrusted the valets with this duty first, because since these men had been in his service or in that of his friends, he had perceived in each of them some different and useful quality. And next, because servants awaken less suspicion than their masters in the minds of the peasants, and excite more sympathy in the minds of those whom they address. And lastly, her ladyship knew the masters, whilst she did not know the servants, who, on the other hand, knew her ladyship well. They were all four to be at an appointed place at 11 o'clock the next day. If they had discovered her ladyship's retreat, three of the four were to remain to watch her, and the fourth was to return to Béthune to inform Athos and to guide the three friends. These arrangements being made, the valets withdrew. Athos then arose from his seat, girded on his sword, wrapped himself up in his cloak, and left the hotel. It was about 10 o'clock, and at 10 at night in the provinces the streets are but little frequented. Nevertheless, Athos evidently was looking out for someone of whom he could ask a question. At last he met a late passenger, went up to him, and spoke a few words. The man he addressed started back in fear, but yet he answered the inquiry of the musketeer by a sign. Athos offered the man half a pistole to accompany him, but he refused it. Athos then proceeded down the street which the man had indicated with his finger, but reaching a spot where several streets met, he stopped again in visible embarrassment. But as this was a more likely place than any other for someone to be seen, Athos waited there. In fact, in an instant after, a watchman passed. Athos repeated the question he had already asked of the person he had first met. The watchman showed the same terror, and also refused to accompany him. But he pointed to the road he was to take. Athos walked in the direction indicated, and soon reached the suburbs of the town, in the opposite direction to that from which he and his companions had entered. There he again appeared uneasy and embarrassed, and stopped for the third time. Fortunately, a beggar who was passing by came up to solicit alms. Athos offered him a crown to accompany him where he was going. The beggar hesitated an instant, but at the sight of the piece of silver shining in the darkness, assented and walked before Athos. Having reached the corner of the street, he pointed out at a distance a small, isolated, melancholy-looking house to which Athos proceeded, whilst the beggar, who had received his fee, took himself off at his utmost speed. Athos walked quite around this house before he could distinguish the door amid the red colour with which the hut was painted. No light pierced through the crevices of the shutters. No sound gave reason to suppose it was inhabited. It was sad and silent as a tomb. Athos knocked 3 times before any answer was returned. At the 3rd knock, however, steps were heard approaching. The door was partially unclosed, and a man of tall stature and pale complexion, and with black beard and hair, appeared. Athos exchanged a few words with him in a whisper, and then the tall man made a sign to the musketeer that he might enter. Athos immediately availed himself of the permission, and the door closed behind him. The man whom Athos had come so far to seek, and whom he had found with so much difficulty, took him into a laboratory, where he was engaged in joining together with iron wires the clattering bones of a skeleton. All the body was already adjusted, and the head alone was lying on the table. All the furniture indicated that the owner of the room in which they were was engaged in natural science. There were bottles filled with serpents, labelled according to their kinds, and dried lizards shining like emeralds set in large frames of black wood. And lastly, boxes of wild, sweet-smelling plants, gifted undoubtedly with virtues unknown to mankind in general, were fastened to the ceiling and hung down the corners of the room. But there was no family, no servant. The tall man inhabited the house alone. Athos cast a cold and indifferent glance on the objects we have just described, and on the invitation of the man whom he had come to seek, sat down opposite him. He then explained the cause of his visit, and the service he required of him. but scarcely had he stated his demand before the stranger, who had remained standing before the musketeer, started back in affright and refused. Athos then drew from his pocket a small paper, on which two lines and a signature were written, accompanied by a seal, and presented it to him who had shown these signs of repugnance so prematurely. The tall man had scarcely read the two lines, and seen the signature, and recognized the seal, before he bowed his head as a token that he had no longer any objection to make, and that he was prepared to obey. Athos demanded nothing more. He arose, left the house, returned by the road he had come, and re-entering the hotel, shut himself up in his own chamber. At daybreak, D'Artagnan entered his room and asked him what they were to do. "Wait," replied Athos. A few moments after, the superior of the convent sent to inform the musketeers that the funeral would take place at midday. As for the murderess, no tidings of her had been heard. It was, however, clear that she must have fled through the garden, on whose gravel paths the traces of her steps could be discerned, and whose door had been found locked, with the key missing. At the appointed hour, Lord de Winter and the four friends proceeded to the convent. The bells were sounding, the chapel was open, and the grating of the choir alone was closed. In the midst of the choir, the body of the victim, clothed in the dress of a novice, lay exposed. On every side of the choir, and behind the grating leading to the convent, the whole community of the Carmelites was assembled, listening to the sacred service, and mingling their strains with the songs of the priests, without seeing the laity or being seen by them. At the door of the chapel, D'Artagnan felt his resolution wavering again, and turned to look for Athos, but he had disappeared. Faithful to his mission of vengeance, Athos had been shown into the garden, and there, on the gravel, following the light steps of that woman who had left a track of blood wherever she had passed, he proceeded onwards until he reached the door which opened on the wood. He had this door unclosed, and he plunged into the forest. But there, all his suspicions were confirmed. The road by which the carriage had disappeared skirted the wood. Athos followed the road for some distance, with his eyes fixed upon the ground. Slight spots of blood, which proceeded from a wound inflicted either on the courier or on one of the horses, were perceptible on the road. About 3/4 of a league off, and 50 paces from Festubert, a large spot of blood was visible, and the ground was trodden by horses. Between the wood and this denunciatory spot, and rather behind the trampled earth, traces of the same small steps as those in the garden were distinguished. The carriage, therefore, had waited here, and here her ladyship had left the wood and got into it. Satisfied with this discovery, which confirmed all his conjectures, Athos returned to the hotel, where he found Planchet impatiently awaiting him. Everything had happened exactly as Athos had foreseen. Planchet had followed the path she had taken, had, like Athos, observed the marks of blood. Like Athos, he, too, had discerned the spot where the carriage stopped. But he had gone on farther than Athos, so that in the village of Festubert, whilst drinking in a tavern, he had, without the trouble of inquiry, learned that at 8:30 yesterday evening, a wounded man who attended a lady travelling in a post-carriage had been obliged to stop from inability to proceed farther. The accident had been imputed to robbers who had stopped the carriage in the wood. The man had remained in the village, but the woman had exchanged horses and proceeded on her journey. Planchet hunted out the postillion who had driven the carriage and found him. He had taken the lady to Fontenelle, and from Fontenelle she had gone on toward Armentières. Planchet had taken a crossroad, and at 7:30 in the morning he was at Armentières. There was only one hotel there, and Planchet presented himself at it as a servant who was looking out for a situation. He had not talked 10 minutes with the servants of the inn before he ascertained that a woman had arrived alone at 10 o'clock the night before, had hired a room, had sent for the landlord, and had told him that she wished to remain for some time in the neighbourhood. Planchet wanted to know nothing more. He hastened to the place of appointment, found the three other valets at their posts, placed them as sentinels at all the outlets from the hotel, and returned to Athos, who had just finished receiving this information from Planchet when his friends returned. All their faces were indicative of gloom, even the gentle countenance of Aramis. "What must we do?" said D'Artagnan. "Wait," replied Athos. Each retired to his own chamber. At 8 o'clock in the evening, Athos ordered the horses to be saddled, and sent word to Lord de Winter and his friends to prepare for the expedition. In an instant all the five were ready. Each looked at his arms and put them in order. Athos came down last and found D'Artagnan already mounted and impatient. "Patience," said Athos. "There is still someone wanting." The four horsemen looked around them in astonishment, for they inquired in vain in their own minds who could be the one still wanting. At this moment Planchet led up Athos's horse. The musketeer leaped lightly into the saddle. "Wait for me," said he. "I shall be back directly." And he went off at a gallop. A quarter of an hour afterwards he returned, accompanied by a man who wore a mask and was wrapped in a red cloak. Lord de Winter and the three musketeers questioned each other by their glances, but none of them could give any information to the others, for all were ignorant about this man. And yet they concluded that it was as it ought to be, since it was Athos who had so arranged it. At 9 o'clock, guided by Planchet, the little cavalcade began its march, taking the same road that the carriage had followed. There was something mournful in the sight of these six men, riding in silence, each buried in his own thoughts, melancholy as despair, gloomy as revenge. 65. The Judgment. It was a dark and stormy night. Large clouds careered along the heavens, veiling the brightness of the stars. The moon would not arise till midnight. Sometimes, by the light of a flash that shone along the horizon, the road became perceptible, stretching itself white and solitary before them. And then, the flash extinguished, everything again was gloom. At every instant Athos was obliged to check D'Artagnan, who was always at the head of the little troop, and to compel him to take his place in the rank, which, a moment afterwards, he quitted again. He had only one thought, to go forward, and he went. They passed in silence through the village of Festubert, where the wounded servant had been left, and then they skirted the village of Richebourg. Having reached Herlier, Planchet, who guided the party, turned to the left. On several occasions either Lord de Winter, or Porthos, or Aramis had endeavoured to address some remark to the man in the red cloak, but at each interrogation he had bowed his head without reply. The travellers had thus comprehended that there was some reason for the stranger's silence, and they had ceased to address him. The storm, too, became more violent. Flashes rapidly succeeded one another. The thunder began to roll, and the wind, the precursor of the hurricane, whistled through the plumes and hair of the horsemen. The cavalcade broke into a fast trot. A little way beyond Fromelles, the storm burst forth. There were still 3 leagues to travel, and they rode them amidst torrents of rain. D'Artagnan had taken off his hat and did not wear his cloak. He found some pleasure in letting the water flow over his burning brow and over his body, agitated by the heats of fever. At the moment that the little troop had passed beyond Goscal, and was just arriving at the change-house, a man who, in the darkness, had been confounded with the trunk of a tree under which he had sheltered himself, advanced into the middle of the road, placing his finger on his lips. Athos recognized Grimaud. "What is the matter now?" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "Can she have quitted Armentières?" Grimaud gave an affirmative nod of the head. D'Artagnan ground his teeth. "Silence, D'Artagnan," said Athos. "I have taken charge of everything, and it is my business, therefore, to question Grimaud." "Where is she?" demanded Athos. Grimaud stretched forth his hand in the direction of the Lys. "Is it far from here?" Grimaud presented his forefinger bent. "Alone?" demanded Athos. Grimaud made a sign that she was. "Gentlemen," said Athos, "she is half a league from this place, in the direction of the river." "Good," said D'Artagnan. "Lead us on, Grimaud." Grimaud took a crossroad and guided the cavalcade. At the end of about 500 yards they found a stream, which they forded. By the light of a flash they perceived the village of Ecquerham. "Is it there?" demanded D'Artagnan. Grimaud shook his head negatively. "Silence there," said Athos. The troop proceeded on its way. Another flash blazed forth, and by the bluish glare of the serpentine flame a small solitary house was perceptible on the bank of the river, not far from a ferry. There was a light at one window. "We are there," said Athos. At that moment a man, who was lying down in a ditch, arose. It was Mousqueton. He pointed with his finger to the window with the light. "She is there," said he. "And Bazin?" demanded Athos. "While I watched the window, he watched the door." "Good," said Athos. "You are all faithful servants." Athos leapt from his horse, of which he gave the bridle into the hands of Grimaud, and advanced in the direction of the window, after having made a sign to the remainder of the troop to proceed towards the door. The small house was surrounded by a quick-set hedge of 2 or 3 feet in height. Athos sprang over the hedge and went up to the window, which had no shutters on the outside, but whose short curtains were closely drawn. He climbed upon the ledge of the stone, that his eye might be above the level of the curtains. By the light of a lamp he could perceive a woman, covered by a dark-coloured cloak, seated on a stool before an expiring fire. Her elbows were placed upon a mean table, and she rested her head on hands which were as white as ivory. Her face was not visible, but an ominous smile arose upon the lips of Athos. He was not mistaken. He had in truth found the woman that he sought. At this moment a horse neighed. Her ladyship raised her head, saw the pale face of Athos staring through the window, and screamed aloud. Perceiving that he had been seen, Athos pushed the window with his hand and knee. It gave way, the panes were broken, and Athos, like a spectre of vengeance, leaped into the room. Her ladyship ran to the door and opened it. Paler and more threatening than even Athos himself, D'Artagnan was standing on the sill. Her ladyship started back and screamed. D'Artagnan, imagining that she had some means of flight, and fearing that she might escape them, drew a pistol from his belt. But Athos raised his hand. "Replace your weapon, D'Artagnan," said he. "It is imperative that this woman should be judged, and not assassinated. Wait a while, D'Artagnan, and you shall be satisfied. Come in, gentlemen." D'Artagnan obeyed, for Athos had the solemn voice and the authoritative air of a judge, commissioned by the deity himself. Behind D'Artagnan there came Porthos, Aramis, Lord de Winter, and the man in the red cloak. The four valets watched at the door and window. Her ladyship had sunk upon her seat, with her hands stretched out, as if to exorcise this terrible apparition. On seeing her brother-in-law, she uttered a fearful scream.
"What do you want?"
demanded her ladyship. "We want," said Athos, "Anne de Broglie, who was called first the Countess de la Fère, then Lady de Winter, Baroness of Sheffield."
"I am that person,"
murmured she, overwhelmed with surprise.
"What do you want with me?"
"We want to judge you according to your crimes," said Athos. "You will be free to defend yourself, and to justify your conduct if you can. Monsieur D'Artagnan, you must be the first accuser." D'Artagnan came forward. "Before God and men," said he, "I accuse this woman of having poisoned Constance Bonancieux, who died last night." He turned towards Aramis and Porthos. "We can bear witness to it," said the two musketeers together. D'Artagnan continued. "Before God and before men, I accuse this woman of having sought to poison me with some wine, which she sent me from Villeroy, with a forged letter, as if the wine had come from my friends. God preserved me, but a man named Brisemont was killed instead of me." "We bear witness to this," said Porthos and Aramis, as with one voice. "Before God and men," continued D'Artagnan, "I accuse this woman of having urged me to the murder of the Baron de Wardes, and, as no one is present to bear witness to it, I myself will attest it. I have done." And D'Artagnan crossed over to the other side of the room with Porthos and Aramis. "It is now for you to speak, my lord," said Athos. The baron came forward in his turn. "Before God and before men," said he, "I accuse this woman of having caused the Duke of Buckingham to be assassinated." "The Duke of Buckingham assassinated?" exclaimed all with one accord. "Yes," said the baron, "assassinated. From the warning letter which you sent me, I caused this woman to be arrested, and put her under the custody of a faithful dependent. She corrupted that man. She placed the dagger in his hand. She made him kill the Duke. And at this moment, perhaps, Felton has paid with his head for the crimes of this fury." A shudder ran through the company at the revelation of these hitherto unsuspected crimes. "This is not all," resumed Lord de Winter. "My brother, who had made you his heiress, died in 3 hours of a strange malady, which left livid spots on his body. Sister, how did your husband die?" "Oh, horror!" exclaimed Porthos and Aramis. Assassin of Buckingham, assassin of Felton, assassin of my brother, I demand justice on you, and declare that if it be not accorded to me, I will execute it myself. Lord de Winter ranged himself by the side of D'Artagnan, leaving his place open to another accuser. Her ladyship's head sank upon her hands, and she endeavored to recall her thoughts, which were confounded by a deadly vertigo. "It is now my turn," said Athos, trembling as the lion trembles at the aspect of a serpent. "It is my turn. I married this woman when she was a young girl. I married her against the desire of all my family. I gave her my property. I gave her my name. And one day I discovered that this woman was branded. This woman bore the mark of a fleur-de-lis upon the left shoulder." "Oh," said her ladyship, rising, "I defy you to find the tribunal which pronounced on me that infamous sentence. I defy you to find the man who executed it."
"Silence," exclaimed a voice. "It is for me to answer that."
And the man in the red cloak came forward.
"Who is that man? What is that man?" cried out her ladyship, suffocated with terror, and with her hair raising itself up on her head, as if it had been endowed with life.
Every eye was turned towards that man, for he was unknown to all except Athos. And even Athos looked at him with as much astonishment as the others, for he knew not how he could be connected with the horrible drama which was at that moment enacting there. After slowly and solemnly approaching her ladyship, till the table alone separated them, the stranger took off his mask. Her ladyship looked for some time with increasing terror on that pale countenance, fringed with black hair, of which the only expression was that of a stern and frozen insensibility. Then, suddenly rising and retreating towards the wall,
"Oh, no, no!" exclaimed she. "No! It is an infernal apparition! It is not he! Help! Help!"
she screamed out in a hoarse voice, still pressing against the wall, as if she could open a passage through it with her hands. "But who are you?" exclaimed all the witnesses of this scene.
"Ask this woman," said the man in the red cloak, "for you see well that she has recognized me."
"The executioner of Lee! The executioner of Lee!"
cried her ladyship, overcome by wild affright, and clinging to the wall with her hands for support. All present recoiled, and the tall man stood alone in the middle of the room.
"Oh, mercy! Mercy!"
cried the miserable woman, falling on her knees. The stranger paused for silence.
"I told you truly that she recognized me," said he. "Yes, I am the executioner of Lille, and here is my history."
All eyes were fixed upon this man, whose words were listened to with the most anxious avidity.
"This woman was formerly a young girl, as beautiful as she is at present. She was a nun in a Benedictine convent at Templemar. A young priest, simple and ingenuous in his nature, performed service in the church of the convent. She attempted to seduce him, and succeeded. She would have seduced a saint. The vows which they had both taken were sacred and irrevocable. She persuaded him to quit the country. But to quit the country, to fly together, to get to some part of France where they might live in peace, because they would be unknown, they required money. Neither of them had any. The priest stole the sacred vessels and sold them. But just as they were making ready to escape, they were both arrested. In 8 days more, she had corrupted the jailer's son and saved herself. The young priest was condemned to be branded and to 10 years of the galleys. I was the executioner of Lille, as this woman says. I was obliged to brand the criminal, and that criminal was my own brother. I then swore that this woman, who had ruined him, who was more than his accomplice, since she had urged him to the crime, should at any rate partake his punishment. I suspected where she was concealed, I followed and discovered her. I bound her and imprinted the same brand on her that I had stamped upon my own brother. The next day, on my return to Lee, my brother also managed to escape. I was accused as his accomplice, and was condemned to remain in prison in his place so long as he should continue at large. My poor brother was not aware of this sentence. He rejoined this woman, and they fled together into Berry, where he obtained a small curacy. This woman passed for his sister. The owner of the estate to which the curacy belonged saw this pretended sister, and fell in love with her. His passion led him to propose to marry her. She left the man whom she had destroyed, and became the Countess de la Fère. All eyes were turned towards Athos, whose true name this was, and he made a sign that the executioner's tale was true. Then, continued the latter, maddened by despair, and resolved to terminate an existence of which the happiness and honor had been thus destroyed, my poor brother returned to Lille, and learning the sentence which had condemned me in his place, he delivered himself up to justice, and hung himself the same night to the grating of his dungeon. After all, to be fair to them, they who had condemned me kept their word. Scarcely was the identity of the dead body proved before my liberty was restored. These are the crimes of which I accuse her. These are the reasons why I branded her.
Monsieur D'Artagnan, said Athos, what is the punishment that you demand for this woman?
The punishment of death, replied D'Artagnan.
My Lord de Winter, continued Athos, what punishment do you demand for this woman?
Death, replied his lordship.
Monsieur Porthos and Aramis, said Athos, you who are her judges, what punishment do you pronounce against this woman?
The punishment of death, replied the two musketeers in a hollow voice.
Her ladyship uttered a fearful cry, and dragged herself a few paces on her knees towards her judges. Athos stretched out his hand towards her.
Anne de Breuil, said he, Countess de la Fère, Lady de Winter, your crimes have wearied men on earth and God in heaven. If you know any prayer, repeat it, for you are condemned and are about to die.
At these words, which left no hope, her ladyship raised herself to her full height and attempted to speak, but her voice failed her. She felt a strong and pitiless hand seize her by the hair and drag her on as irresistibly as fate drags on mankind. She did not therefore even attempt to make any resistance, but left the cottage. Lord de Winter and the four friends went out after her. The valets followed their masters, and the chamber was left empty, with its broken window, its open door, and the smoking lamp burning sadly on the table. 66. The Execution. It was almost midnight. The waning moon, as red as blood from the lingering traces of the storm, was rising behind the little village of Armentières, which exhibited, in that pale light, the gloomy outline of its houses and the skeleton of its high, ornamented steeple. In front, the Lys rolled along its waters like a river of molten fire, whilst on its other bank a dark mass of trees was sharply outlined upon a stormy sky, covered by large, copper-coloured clouds, which created a sort of twilight in the middle of the night. To the left arose an old, deserted mill, of which the sails were motionless, and from the ruins of which an owl was uttering its sharp, monotonous, recurring screech. Here and there, in the plain, to the right and left of the path which the melancholy train was pursuing, there appeared a few short and stunted trees, which looked like distorted dwarfs crouched down to watch the men in that ill-omened hour. From time to time a brilliant flash opened up the horizon in its whole extent, playing above the black mass of trees, and coming like a frightful scimitar to divide the sky and water into equal parts. Not a breath of air was stirring in the heavy atmosphere. A silence as of death weighed down all nature. The earth was moist and slippery from the recent rain, and reanimated plants sent forth their perfumes with more vigorous energy. Two of the servants, each holding an arm, were leading her ladyship along. The executioner walked behind. The four musketeers and Lord de Winter followed him in turn. Planchet and Bazin brought up the rear. The two valets led her ladyship toward the bank of the river. Her mouth was mute, but her eyes were inexpressibly eloquent, supplicating by turns each of those on whom she looked. Finding herself a few paces in advance, she said to the valets, "A 1,000 pistoles for each of you, if you will assist me to escape. But if you give me up to your masters, I have some avengers near who will make you pay dearly for my death." Grimaud hesitated, and Mousqueton trembled in every limb. Athos, who had heard her ladyship's voice, came up immediately, as did also Lord de Winter. "Send away these valets," said he. "She has spoken to them, and they are no longer to be trusted." They called Planchet and Bazin, who took the places of Grimaud and Mousqueton. Having reached the brink of the stream, the executioner came up and bound her ladyship's hands and feet. She then broke her silence to exclaim, "You are cowards! You are miserable assassins! You come, 10 of you, to murder a poor woman. But beware, though I am not assisted, I shall be avenged." "You are not a woman," replied Athos coldly. "You do not belong to the human race. You are a demon, escaped from hell, and to hell we shall send you back." "Oh, you stainless gentleman," said her ladyship. "Remember that he amongst you who touches a hair of my head is himself a murderer."
"The executioner can kill without being on that account a murderer, madam," said the man in the cloak, striking his large sword. "He is the last judge on earth. That is all. Nachrichter, as our German neighbors say."
And, as he was binding her whilst he uttered these words, her ladyship sent forth 2 or 3 wild screams, which had a startling melancholy effect, as they were borne on the night and lost themselves amidst the depths of the woods like birds.
"But if I am guilty, if I have committed the crimes of which you accuse me," howled out her ladyship, "take me before a regular tribunal. You are not judges. You have no power to condemn me."
"I did propose Tyburn," answered Lord de Winter. "Why did you not accept my offer?"
"Because I do not wish to die," exclaimed her ladyship, struggling. "Because I am too young to die."
"The woman whom you poisoned at Béthune was still younger than you are, madam, and yet she is dead," said D'Artagnan.
"I will enter a convent. I will become a nun," cried her ladyship.
"You were in a convent," said the executioner, "and you left it to destroy my brother."
Her ladyship uttered a cry of terror and fell upon her knees. The executioner lifted her in his arms and prepared to carry her to the boat.
"Oh, my God!" exclaimed she. "My God! Are you going to drown me?"
These cries had something so heart-rending in them that D'Artagnan, who was at first the most unrelenting in his pursuit of her ladyship, sank down upon the stump of a tree, letting his head fall on his bosom, and stopping his ears with the palms of his hands. And yet, in spite of all this, he still heard her menaces and cries. D'Artagnan was the youngest of all these men, and his heart failed him.
"Oh, I cannot bear this frightful spectacle," said he. "I cannot consent that this woman should thus die."
Her ladyship heard these words, and they gave her a new gleam of hope.
"D'Artagnan! D'Artagnan!" exclaimed she. "Remember that I have loved you!"
The young man rose and made a step towards her, but Athos drew his sword and placed himself in his path.
"If you take one step more, D'Artagnan," said he, "we must cross our swords together." D'Artagnan fell on his knees and prayed. "Come," continued Athos. "Executioner, do your duty."
"Willingly, my lord," replied the executioner.
for as truly as I am a good Catholic, I firmly believe that I act justly in exercising my office on this woman."
"That is right." Athos took one step towards her ladyship. "I pardon you," said he, "the evil you have done me. I forgive you for my future crushed, my honor lost, my love tainted, and my salvation forever perilled by the despair into which you have thrown me. Die in peace." Lord de Winter next came forward. "I pardon you," said he, "the poisoning of my brother, the assassination of the Duke of Buckingham, and the death of poor Felton. I forgive you your attempts on my own person. Die in peace."
"As for me," said D'Artagnan, "pardon me, madame, for having, by a deceit unworthy of a gentleman, provoked your rage. And in exchange, I pardon you for the murder of my poor friend, and your cruel vengeance on myself. I pardon and I pity you. Die in peace."
"I am lost," murmured her ladyship in English. "I must die."
She then arose unaided, and threw around her one of those clear glances which seemed to emanate from an eye of fire. But she could see nothing. She listened, but she heard nothing. There were none around her but her enemies.
"Where am I to die?" demanded she.
"On the other bank of the river," replied the executioner.
He then placed her in the boat, and as he was stepping in after her, Athos gave him a sum of money. "Here," said he, "here is the price of the execution, that it may be seen that we are really judges."
"It is well," said the executioner. "But let this woman now know that I am not executing my business, but my duty."
And he threw the money from him into the river.
"Mark," said Athos, "this woman has a child, and yet she has not said one word about him."
The boat proceeded towards the left bank of the Lys, carrying away the criminal and the executioner. All the others continued on the right bank, where they had sunk upon their knees. The boat glided slowly along the rope of the ferry under the reflection of a pale mist, which skimmed the water at that moment. It arrived at the other bank, and the two figures stood out in blackness on the red horizon. During the passage, her ladyship had managed to loosen the cord that bound her feet, and, on reaching the bank, she leapt lightly on shore and took to flight. But the ground was moist, and at the top of the shelving bank she slipped and fell upon her knees. Probably a superstitious idea had struck her. She understood that heaven refused to aid her, and remained in the attitude in which she had fallen, her head drooping and her hands clasped together. Then, from the other shore, they could see the executioner slowly raise his two arms. A ray of the moon was reflected on the blade of his large sword. The two arms descended. They heard the whistling of the scimitar and the cry of the victim. And then a mutilated mass sank down beneath the blow. The executioner took off his red cloak, stretched it out on the ground, laid the body on it, and threw in the head, tied it by the four corners, swung it upon his shoulders, and again entered the boat. Having reached the middle of the Lys, he stopped the boat, and holding his burden over the river,
"Let the justice of God have its course," he exclaimed in a loud voice.
And, so saying, he dropped the dead body into the deepest part of the waters, which closed above it. 67. A Message from the Cardinal. 3 days afterwards, the four musketeers re-entered Paris. They were within the limit of their furlough, and the same evening they went to pay the usual visit to Monsieur de Treville.
"Well, gentlemen," inquired the brave captain, "have you found yourselves amused in your excursion?"
"Prodigiously so," replied Athos, in his own name and that of his companions. On the 6th of the following month, the king, according to his promise to the cardinal to return to Rochelle, quitted Paris, still quite stunned by the news which was beginning to circulate in the city that Buckingham had been assassinated. Although warned of a danger in the path of a man whom she had so truly loved, yet the queen, when his death was announced to her, would not believe it. She had even the imprudence to exclaim, "It is false! He has just written to me!" But the next day there was no refusing credence to this fatal news. Laporte, having, like everyone else, been detained by the order of Charles I, at length arrived, and brought with him the last dying gift which Buckingham had sent to the queen. The king's joy had been extreme. He did not take the slightest pains to disguise it, but manifested it affectedly before the queen. Louis XIII, like all men of weak hearts, was wanting in generosity. But the king soon again became melancholy and ill. His brow was not one of those that can continue long unruffled. He felt that, in returning to the camp, he returned to slavery, and yet he did return there. The cardinal was, to him, the fascinating serpent, and he was the bird that flies from bough to bough without a possibility of making his escape. The return to La Rochelle was, therefore, profoundly melancholy. Our four friends especially excited the astonishment of their companions. They travelled side by side, with heavy eyes and heads depressed. Athos alone sometimes raised his broad forehead. A glance shot from his eye, a bitter smile passed across his lips, and then, like his comrades, he sank again into his reveries. As soon as they arrived in any town, when they had conducted the king to his apartments, the four friends withdrew, either to their own lodgings or to some secluded tavern, where they neither played nor drank, but spoke in a low voice together, and looked attentively that none might hear them. One day that the king had halted to hunt the magpie, and the four friends, according to their custom, instead of joining in the sport, had stopped at a tavern by the roadside, a man, who was coming post-haste from La Rochelle, stopped at the door to drink a glass of wine, and looked into the chamber where the four musketeers were seated at a table.
"Hullo, Monsieur D'Artagnan," said he. "Is it you that I see there?"
D'Artagnan raised his head and uttered an exclamation of joy. This man, who now called him, was his phantom. It was the stranger of Meung, of the Rue des Fossoyeurs, and of Arras. D'Artagnan drew his sword and rushed towards the door. But on this occasion the stranger, instead of hastening away, jumped off his horse and advanced to meet him.
"Ah, sir," said the young man, "I meet you at last. This time you shall not escape me."
"It is not my intention either, sir, for I am looking for you this time. In the king's name, I arrest you."
"What do you mean?" exclaimed D'Artagnan.
"I say that you must give up your sword to me, sir, and without resistance, too. Your life depends upon it, I assure you."
"Who are you, then?"
demanded D'Artagnan, lowering his sword, but not yet giving it up.
"I am the Chevalier de Rochefort," said the stranger, "the Cardinal de Richelieu's master of the horse, and I am commanded to conduct you before His Eminence."
"We are now returning to His Eminence, sir," said Athos, coming forward, "and you must take Monsieur D'Artagnan's word that he will go direct to La Rochelle."
"I must place him in the hands of the guards who will conduct him back to the camp."
"We will serve as such, sir, on our words as gentlemen. But on our words as gentlemen also," continued Athos, frowning, "Monsieur D'Artagnan shall not be taken from us."
De Rochefort threw a glance behind him, and saw that Porthos and Aramis had placed themselves between him and the door, and he understood that he was entirely at the mercy of these four men.
"Gentlemen," said he, "if Monsieur D'Artagnan will deliver up his sword and add his word to yours, I will be contented with your promise of conducting him to the quarters of His Eminence the Cardinal."
"You have my word, sir. And here is my sword," said D'Artagnan.
"That suits me so much the better," said Rochefort, "as I must continue my journey."
"If it is to rejoin her ladyship," said Athos coolly, "it is useless. You will not find her."
"And what has become of her?" asked Rochefort anxiously.
"Return to the camp, and you will learn."
Rochefort remained in thought for an instant, and then, as they were only one day's journey from Surgères, where the cardinal was to meet the king, he resolved to follow Athos's advice and to return with them. Besides, this plan had the further advantage of enabling him personally to watch the prisoner. Thus they proceeded on their journey. The next day, at 3 in the afternoon, they reached Surgères. The cardinal was waiting there for Louis XIII. The minister and the king exchanged their caresses freely and congratulated each other on the happy chance which had freed France from the inveterate enemy who was arming Europe against her. After this, the cardinal, who had been informed by Rochefort that D'Artagnan had been placed under arrest, and who was in haste to interrogate him, took leave of the king, inviting his majesty to go the next day to see the works at the embankment, which were at last complete. On returning in the evening to his quarters, near the Pont de la Pierre, the cardinal found the three musketeers all armed, and D'Artagnan, who was without his sword, standing before the door of the house which he inhabited. On this occasion, as he had all his retinue about him, he looked sternly at them, and made a sign with his eye and hand for D'Artagnan to follow him. D'Artagnan obeyed. "We will wait for you, D'Artagnan," said Athos, loud enough for the cardinal to hear. His Eminence knitted his brow, stopped for an instant, and then went on, without uttering a single word. D'Artagnan entered behind the cardinal, and Rochefort followed D'Artagnan. The door was guarded. His Eminence entered the chamber, which he made use of as a cabinet, and signed to Rochefort to introduce the young musketeer. Rochefort obeyed and retired. D'Artagnan stood alone before the cardinal. It was his second interview with Richelieu, and he afterwards confessed that he felt quite convinced that it was to be his last. Richelieu remained leaning upon the chimney-piece, and there was a table standing between him and D'Artagnan. "Sir," said the cardinal, "you have been arrested by my orders." "So I have been informed, my lord." "Do you know why?"
"No, my lord. For the only thing for which I ought to be arrested is yet unknown to your Eminence."
Richelieu looked earnestly at the young man.
"Hullo," said he, "what does this mean? If your Eminence will first tell me the charges against me, I will afterwards tell you what I have done." "There are crimes imputed to you which have cost the heads of people higher far than you are," replied the cardinal.
"And what are they, my lord?" demanded D'Artagnan, with a calmness which surprised even the cardinal himself.
"You are accused of corresponding with the enemies of the realm, of having pried into the secrets of the state, and of having attempted to make your general's plans miscarry."
"And who is my accuser, my lord?" inquired D'Artagnan, who had no doubt that it was her ladyship.
"A woman branded by the justice of her country, a woman who was married to one man in France and to another in England, a woman who poisoned her second husband and attempted to poison me."
"What are you saying, sir?" exclaimed the astonished cardinal. "And of what woman are you thus speaking?"
"Of Lady de Winter," replied D'Artagnan. "Yes, of Lady de Winter, of whose crimes your Eminence was undoubtedly ignorant when you honored her with your confidence."
"Sir," said the cardinal, "if Lady de Winter has been guilty of the crimes you have mentioned, she shall be punished."
"She has been punished, my lord."
"And who has punished her?"
"We have."
"She is in prison, then?"
"She is dead."
"Dead?"
repeated the cardinal, who could not credit what he heard.
"Dead? Did you say that she was dead? 3 times she had endeavored to kill me, and 3 times I forgave her. But she murdered the woman I loved, and then my friends and I seized her, tried her, and condemned her."
D'Artagnan then related the poisoning of Madame Bonancieux in the Carmelite convent at Béthune, the trial in the solitary house, and the execution on the banks of the Lys. A shudder ran through the frame of the cardinal, who was not made to shudder easily. But suddenly, as if from the influence of some silent thought, his dark countenance became gradually clearer, and at last attained perfect serenity.
"So," said he, in a voice the gentleness of which contrasted strangely with the severity of his words, "you constituted yourselves the judges, without considering that those who are not legally appointed, and punish without authority, are assassins."
"My lord,
I swear to you that I have not for one instant thought of defending my head against your eminence. I will submit to whatever punishment your eminence may please to inflict. I do not cling to life sufficiently to fear death.
Yes, I know it. You are a man of courage, sir, said the cardinal, in a voice almost affectionate. I may therefore tell